Even though the recession has officially ended, millions of households are struggling to make it into the middle class in this country or just stay there at all. A conversation about that just ahead. Good Monday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. Hope you had a great weekend. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9. Make sure to subscribe to the daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher and watch the show with video on demand at tvjax.com. Just ahead, we'll take your calls on the shrinking middle class. How tough is it in your household to keep earning that middle class income? What do you think of as the middle class? How do you define it? Give us a call, 549-2937. Then later, a conversation with the local author of the new book, The Nazi Hunters, why there are more stay-at-home dads in our area, and Culpepper on sports, all of that ahead. But first this hour, a new report from the Pew Research Center is taking a closer look at a growing phenomenon, America's shrinking middle class. In most American cities, what you think of as the lower class, lower income households, is growing, while the number of people making middle incomes is shrinking. This is a brand new phenomenon. Jacksonville is one large city where we're really seeing this trend play out, with fewer people making middle class incomes and more people tumbling into the working or lower class. We're going to explain how those incomes are defined in a moment, but with a closer look at what's driving this, we welcome Jenny Stuber, Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of North Florida. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And here's our question to callers. What do you think constitutes a middle class income? Is your household middle class, lower class, working class, or upper class? What do you think that means? Call us up, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email, tweet us, weigh in on Facebook. And so the Pew Research Center looks at this hollowing out of the middle class all over the country. And according to the new study, they attribute it to a mix of technological change, globalization, jobs that have been outsourced or automated, and declining wages for manufacturing workers, low-skilled workers. As you look at these numbers, what are the biggest things sticking out to you, Jenny, all over the country?
I think when you look at the map that the Pew Research Organization has established, you see really visible patterns. And I think so much of what we understand economically or sociologically or about data is very visual. And so you look at the map and it's very, very clear that the cities that have been losing ground, so to speak, with respect to the middle class are those that are located in the South. There's some that are located in the Central Valley of California. What you didn't mention in your opening comments is there are also cities in which the upper classes are gaining.
Yes.
And that's an equally important pattern. And there we see that some of the cities that have had some slight gains in the proportion of the population represented or categorized as upper class are those that have experienced, as you mentioned, gains in the tech economy, gains in research, and gains in biotech as well. And those are some cities both in the Bay Area and along the East Coast. So that's an equal pattern, but it is very interesting to talk about this as both a national phenomena, because we do have national data that express these patterns, but also as highly localized phenomena.
Absolutely. Let's get local and look at Florida, in particular, the Jacksonville metropolitan area. What is sticking out? What are we seeing in terms of incomes right here on the First Coast?
In some ways, Jacksonville looks a lot like the national patterns. And what I see there is that nationally, about 28% of the population falls into the category that Pew labeled as lower class. And that's 29% here in Jacksonville. And similarly, the proportion of the populations labeled middle class and in the upper income groups are also very similar in Jacksonville to the national pattern. And what we see, as you mentioned also in your opening comments, is that the proportion of the population since 2000 that has lost ground in the middle class here in Jacksonville is similar to the national pattern as well.
And we'll go to your calls in a moment as we look at the new Pew study on the shrinking middle class in this country. Fewer and fewer households are able to bring in what is defined as a middle class income in 2016. We want your calls and stories about your family finances. We'll go to the phones in a moment at 549-2937. Let's explain how Pew defines middle class, because the majority of Americans think of themselves as middle class, even if they're not, even if they're upper middle class or perhaps a little more working class income. What is middle class?
Yeah, middle class status has that subjective element that you mentioned. Many Americans, at least 50% of Americans, subjectively define themselves as middle class. When you move away from a subjective definition of middle class to an objective definition of middle class, you get into really sticky territory because there really isn't one single agreed upon definition as to what the middle class is. Pew defined it this way: those who are two-thirds of the median income, up to twice the median income. So another way of thinking about that is anyone is middle class who makes somewhat below the median as well as twice as much as the median. And that's a really, really wide swath of the population, something between 40,000 and somewhere between 120. I don't have the exact numbers in front of me. Actually, I do. Anywhere between $42,000 at the household level to $125,000 at the household level is what they defined as middle class.
A more expensive city would look at an income of $100,000+ a year as middle income.
Yeah.
In Jacksonville, how would you categorize a middle income?
Right. There are a lot of calculators online that you can look to compare the cost of living parity across different communities, but it is absolutely true, as you indicate, that earning $100,000 in the Bay Area or $100,000 in Boston is nowhere near the same as earning $100,000 in Jacksonville, rather. Your money's going to go a lot farther here. So that's interesting to consider as well in terms of what this actually means as far as standard of living and day-to-day experiences.
And when you look at the reasons why fewer Americans are able to attain this middle class status, what are your biggest concerns about that? Because for the first time in this country now, there are more people at the upper end and the lower end than in the great middle.
Yeah, this is a long-term economic trend. There are those commentators on the internet who want to attribute it to certain kinds of presidential politics and partisan divides and that type of thing. But this is a long-term economic trend. I think that's really important to point out. When you look at the consequences, as you said, what are you most concerned about? The hollowing out of the middle is a really important phenomenon to consider for both material, that is to say economic, and non-material, that is to say symbolic reasons. So the hollowing out of the middle on an economic level means that fewer people can stimulate the economy. We know that the middle class is the economic stimulus of our economy since we are a heavily based consumer economy. But it also has symbolic or non-material impacts because a hollowing out of the middle also means that fewer people may feel engaged in their communities. They may be less likely to vote. They may experience lower levels of social trust. So it also leads to the possibility that communities may fray, disintegrate at a greater level, and have other kinds of problems holding society and communities together.
Let's go to your calls right now as we look at the shrinking middle class here on the First Coast and all over the country. What's going on in your household? How do you define a middle-class income? What are your financial struggles, if any? 549-2937. Anne Marie. Hi, Anne Marie in Jacksonville. Good morning.
Oh, hi. I think the cost of living has skyrocketed. I'm sure you've heard this before. Wages have stagnated, and I have lived through it because in 1962, my husband and I bought a home in Levittown, Pennsylvania, the suburbs of Philadelphia, for $10,000. A single home, three bedrooms, bath, nice property, porch, everything. He was making $70 a week, like minimum wage at 7-Eleven. He was a clerk. We were able to pay our mortgage, our utilities, buy our food, a used car payment, and feed ourselves. I didn't have to work. But today, that same house is still sitting there, Levittown, Pennsylvania, over $200,000. I mean, you know, that's just one example of the cost of living skyrocketing.
Okay.
If the minimum wage kept up with this cost of living, I mean, the rate is 15 now, it actually should be 30 if it kept up with the cost of living.
Thanks for the call. Jenny Stuber.
Well, there's so much to unpack with that, the caller's comments. And one of the things is that there's been a shrinking of the middle class at the same time that families have had more earners within the household. So these are household level incomes that are shrinking. And as the caller intimates, this is an era today in which there are often two workers in the household. So that adds insult to injury when you look at it that way.
People feel, and I think so many of us listening and people I work with, people I know in other companies, you feel like you're running as fast as you can, both the husband and wife or whoever, whatever constitutes your household, just to stay in place.
Yeah. On the one hand, over time, when you look at inflation-adjusted incomes as well as the cost of living, there are certain things that are easier for Americans to attain. A lot of consumer goods actually have gone down in price relative to where they were back in the 70s and the 60s. But a number of really key things have gone up in price, and that's healthcare and higher education in particular have increased around 300%. So if those are things that are important aspects of your budget, you're really going to feel the pain because incomes have absolutely not gone up by 300% in this time period.
And you mentioned presidential politics. Of course, 2016 has been extraordinary in terms of two candidates in particular tapping into this really widespread anxiety and anger about jobs, falling incomes. Donald Trump blaming a whole host of factors. Critics have said he's blamed people in a xenophobic way. He's also blamed our trade agreements. Bernie Sanders has tapped into this populist vein by blaming the big banks and what he calls a rigged economy, an economy rigged toward only the very upper incomes. When you hear about these policy prescriptions these candidates are touting on the campaign trail, what do you think?
I think the things that I'm most concerned about are the consequences of the rhetoric that exists out there. I don't particularly like a rhetoric that makes people who are in many ways victims or paying the prices of these economic transformations look to each other as the enemy. And I see that as one of the threads that's running through the political season is looking at those who are suffering from these changes turning upon each other and turning to a politics of race rather than seeing in maybe a more populist vein the ways in which there's commonality among those who are on the lower end and the importance of understanding how collectively we're all in this together.
And it's 549-2937. Jamie in Atlantic Beach. Hi, Jamie. What are you thinking?
Hey, I love the comment just made about how I feel like I'm running as fast as I can and I'm slowly going backwards. My wife and I both work 6-7 days a week, a couple of jobs apiece, doing our damnedest to stay in that middle class, streamlining the budget, everything. And like I heard my wife say in a moment of stress, I tried to support her, but she's like, I'm so tired of being poor. And I just think there's a bunch of us out there. We're community focused. We try to vote in our best interest. And I just don't know how to fix it other than pulling my boots up every morning and working hard. The flip side is I know we got it better than a good piece of the world, but is there anything we can do? I mean, our budget is tight. We work hard. I don't have an answer. I just wanted to give you my personal experience as a guy living in the area.
Yeah. Jamie, thanks so much. Thanks for calling. And I think he speaks for so many Americans. And so when he says, what can we do? Well, that's the great debate we're having right now in this country. What policies can ease the financial crunch for so many Americans? We are officially out of the recession. Productivity is way up. The stock market is up. But average Americans who are working hard are not being given the fruits of their labor in terms of pay increases. What about this?
I think the caller's emotions are really evident in terms of the consequences to this. And one of the things that is often discussed in this terrain when we look at in this particular regard, not necessarily the hollowing out of the middle class, but a related but different concept, and that is to say the growing divide in income inequality. When you have a society like ours, where the wealth gap and the income gap, and this note, by the way, that this report is only about income. If Pew had produced a report that included indicators of wealth and how the distribution of wealth had changed over time, the results would be far more severe. And what I wanted to bring back and say about that is that when wealth and income in the United States have become so unequal as they have since the early 1970s, it's not just an economic issue. This is an issue with very profound civic consequences, as the caller mentioned. I'm doing what I'm supposed to do. I'm trying to vote. I'm trying to be civically engaged. But when you see such a disparity, as the caller does, between what the United States has promised and his wife's reality, then you get a situation where people sort of lose faith in everything that this country purports to be about, and the American dream loses its legitimacy, and that's when we're in a really problematic situation is when so many people begin to question the legitimacy of what this country is about and what their role is in making it great.
And if you're just tuning in, lots of calls as we discuss the new Pew Research report on America's shrinking middle class. We want to hear your stories, your comments right now at 549-2937. Let's go to Danny in Middleburg. Hey, Danny. Thanks for calling. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, I was wondering about the government regulations that were back in the 70s that enforced the union rules. It wasn't the union that was participating as much as the government. It used to be where the inspectors used to come out to the job sites and inspect what was on the job, and there was a ladder to climb, a caste system where there was helpers, there was grunts, there was apprentices, there was journeymen, there was supervisors, there was foremen. And there's no ladder for people to climb no more. And I'll take your information off the air.
Thanks, Danny.
So the comment about unions is actually really important to weave into this conversation. Although it's just a correlation, you do see that the proportion of union membership closely parallels, and the decline, I should say, in union membership closely parallels the decline of the middle class or declining incomes in the United States. So what you see is that in the early 1970s, some 30, 35, 36% of Americans were members of labor unions. Today, that number's down to about 8%. And really, workers have had their voice eroded in this process. Our society is very skeptical about unions. There's a lot of political rhetoric around unions. There's a lot of evidence that some unions have engaged in self-serving behaviors and haven't served the workers who are members of those unions. But you can't take the question of unions off the table when you're discussing the declining middle class, as those two things seem to be related in some particular way.
And what about the new rule that came down just the other day from the Obama administration about paying workers below a certain salary overtime?
Yeah. I think what I get concerned about when I hear things like that is the possible unintended negative consequences and how employers may game the system and change some aspects of the work rules to and that's what it's intended to do, is because there were so many employers who were having their employees work off the clock, and this is intended in part to right those and correct those wrongs, but I get worried about the unintended consequences in terms of how employers might game the system.
Chip is in St. Augustine this morning. Hi, Chip. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. It kind of started, in my opinion, in the 60s. At that time, a son could follow father in their occupation, expect to get a few more dollars an hour in wages and have a little bit better lifestyle, get a little bit better house, a little bit better car. Everything was moving fine. Reagan kind of came in, deregulated everything, and that's when the executive pay shot up from like 50 to 100 times what a worker makes to thousands of times what a worker makes. And now these people have piles and piles of money that can't buy them any larger boat than they've got. And the people are suffering, and they don't realize that it's the middle class that supports the economy. They're the people who want another little small boat and another house and a vacation every now and then. And then the politicians all have everybody all distracted with, oh, gee, what bathroom are you going to use? You know, don't worry that you can't buy bread. Let's make sure that, you know, nobody uses the wrong bathroom. We have to call the politicians down. That's why Bernie Sanders has such a big following. He's talking about taking the billions out of the pockets of the billionaires and helping the middle class, which will then in turn help the billionaires again. So that's just the way I see it.
Thanks, Chip. And by the way, here's another point of view email from Paul. Isn't it a double-edged sword? Yes, the cost of living has increased, but what about our pervasive desire to live beyond our means? So two points of view there, Jenny Stuber.
The point I think I want to address is the caller's point of view. And what I think is really powerful about that is thinking about these are long-term trends with the hollowing out of the middle class, and they're not something that we can simplify in one simple explanation, not even one simple economic explanation in terms of transformation of the economy and jobs. This is something that's happening and reflects policies in terms of taxation. And the policies that have hollowed out the incomes of those working at the middle class are very different than those that have allowed members of the upper classes to retain more of their income.
Calls from across the listening area. Patrick in Callahan. Go ahead, Patrick. Good morning.
In terms of taxation,
Okay, Patrick, I'm going to put you back on hold. Give us a call back and turn down your radio. Let's go to John in downtown Jacksonville. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for taking my call. I'm jumping into this conversation a little bit late, but has your guest alluded to the waterways?
No, we're not going to talk about waterways today, John. I'm sorry. I know what you want to talk about, but that's not today's discussion. Thanks anyway. Joe in Jacksonville. Go ahead, Joe.
Good morning. I'd like to point out that when we talk about the decline in the standard of living over time, the actual the criteria have changed. I'm in my 60s. When I grew up, a middle-class family had a 1,200-square-foot home, one car, one television, one telephone. Now, that same family is expected to have three cars, 3,000-square-foot house, and everybody's got a phone in their pocket.
Right.
And this is what's been sold to us, and we've been convinced that we need all this stuff to be happy, and it's just not the same ballgame.
Yeah.
And we've been sold a bill of goods.
Okay, thanks, that's Joe. Okay, so are people trying too hard to keep up with the Joneses and put together how they define a middle-class life? Or are our expectations too high sometimes?
I will admit that I am sympathetic to that point of view, and I think it's part of the politics of distraction. As the earlier caller mentioned, some of the bathroom politics that are going around right now, I think this is also one of those phenomena. By this, I mean the consumer habits of the American people is something that distracts us from what's kind of really going on. The fact of the matter is that we can afford $200 TVs. We can afford them by virtue of the fact that they are very cheap, but we can also afford them by virtue of the fact that the credit card industry has extended long lines of credit very readily to people who may not have the means to pay, and then engage in a variety of tricks and tactics to generate revenue from late payments and so forth. So I do think that to the extent that we can focus on where we're going to have dinner tonight and what the latest gadget is that we're going to buy, that we are missing sort of and taking our eyes off the ball of what's really going on.
A few comments on our Facebook page. The cost of living continues to rise, but corporations refuse to give raises. And if they do, it's in such small amounts, it doesn't make a difference. In my clerical position, I'm always in fear my job will be shipped overseas. And here's another comment. Brand new phenomenon. It's older than my adult kids. It's been coming on for the last 40 years. Just a couple comments on our Facebook page. Let's take one more call. David on the South Side. Go ahead, David.
Yes, I think that one of the biggest problems that will be long-term results is the corruption we face by everyone feeling that money solves all problems. We can buy the laws we want. We can get the business environment we want by propaganda and everything else. The problem is at the base of our American myth is thinking of the old cowboys, where if you're in a poker game and the guy is cheating, you turn the table over and the fight begins. And that is absolutely what I think is happening with Trump. Many people don't support him. He is a terrible problem. But it is that sort of turning the table over because they see no alternative.
Thanks, David. Okay. What about his comments there regarding Donald Trump?
I think what I'm seeing from your callers, or hearing from your callers rather, is the emotion that people are feeling right now. And it expresses a degree of powerlessness as well as befuddlement as to what's happening in some of our presidential politics right now.
Always good to talk to you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Jenny Stuber, Associate Professor of Sociology at UNF. Thanks to everyone who called in today on that one. And much more still ahead later, Culpepper on sports. Also, hear from the growing number of stay-at-home dads here on the First Coast. But up next, tracking down the last remaining henchmen of the Third Reich, a conversation with the author of The Nazi Hunters. We're back in a moment.
I'm Rick Mullaney, Director of the Public Policy Institute at Jacksonville University. Join me for WJCT's quarterly program, Policy Matters. On each installment, we look at how public policy affects our lives. Join the conversation as we speak with Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry and Greg Anderson, President of the Jacksonville City Council. That's on the next Policy Matters, Thursday morning at 9 on 89.9 WJCT.
WJCT and Baptist Health are pleased to announce that Amy Robach, news anchor of ABC's Good Morning America, will be this year's afternoon keynote speaker at Girls' Day Out, September 17, 2016, Hyatt Regency Riverfront Hotel. Amy is also a breast cancer awareness advocate and author of My Breast Cancer Journey, From Fighter to Thriver. For more information or for tickets, log on to wjct.org/girlsdayout.
Texas high schoolers in the top 10% of their class are guaranteed a place at any public university in that state, except for the flagship UT campus in Austin.
Unless you have done extraordinary things and can present a kind of a unique portfolio to the admissions office, it's very hard to get in.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hook 'em horns if you can get in. Marketplace next time.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
On the next Fresh Air, Susan Silverman, the older sister of comedian Sarah Silverman. She's a rabbi and lives in Israel. After giving birth to two daughters, she and her husband adopted two boys from Ethiopia. She's become an advocate for international adoption, which has been in decline, and is the author of the new book, Casting Lots. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, it's a fascinating look at the small band of men and women who've refused to allow the crimes of the Third Reich to be forgotten and who are determined to track down Nazi war criminals. Author Andrew Nagorski, who happens to live in St. Augustine, joins us now with more about his new book, The Nazi Hunters. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And what are your thoughts about the 70th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz and a look at men and women who are determined to track down and bring Nazis to justice? Give us a call, 549-2937. It's hard to believe it's been 70 years since the liberation of Auschwitz, and there are really only a few people still living who have not been brought to justice officially. But your book educates us about this entire phenomenon. And also, I want to begin by asking you, 8 million Germans were members of the Nazi Party. So that's a big group of people that Nazi hunters could have theoretically gone after, right?
In theory, I don't think there was ever an intention to go after all 8 million Nazis. And being a member of the party wasn't necessarily the criteria. It's what you did, what you served. If you were, for instance, a guard in a killing camp like Auschwitz or Sobibor, that's quite different than being, say, a minor official, even if you are a member of the party. But you're absolutely right. There were plenty of people that could have been taken to court and were not. And so what I try to explain in my book is the whole process from the beginning, the Nuremberg trials, to right now, these last trials, and who kept this process alive.
And these were people who were determined and often faced a very difficult journey to track down people that were, in fact, culpable. And by the time, for example, a 94-year-old former Auschwitz guard named Reinhold Hanning, he didn't finally see a courtroom till he was in his 90s. That is just extraordinary.
Yes. Well, if you do the math, if you still have trials now, more than 70 years after the war, anybody in his low 20s at the end of the war would now be in the 90s. So, of necessity, these are people who were pretty down in the pecking order of the whole killing machines. But the point that people who are advocating these trials, these last remaining trials, is to make is that, for instance, if you had your family was killed by some gang, right, that was targeting you because of your race, religion, or whatever the criteria, and 70 years later you saw one of the murderers on the street and lived a peaceful life, you'd still want at least a verdict to say there's some responsibility here, whether or not this person is ever punished.
And Germany has changed the criteria for who can be prosecuted. How helpful has that been?
That's made a major difference. In fact, after the war, West Germany treated most of these cases as ordinary criminal cases, as if, you know, these were just murder cases, you know, thousands and even million times over. So in each case, you had to bring evidence, say so-and-so was guilty of killing so-and-so or torturing. Now they say if you were a guard in what was essentially a killing machine, a camp that was just set up as a death camp, you knew what you were part of. And even if you did not physically kill, you were part of that killing machine. And that's made it possible to get some of these remaining cases on the books.
Tell us a little bit about the individuals who have really dedicated an extraordinary amount of time and energy over many years to bring Nazis to justice.
Yeah, well, there was a relatively small group, and there were people who were government prosecutors, investigators. So that's one part of one type of Nazi hunter. Then there were people, for instance, Holocaust survivors, most famously Simon Wiesenthal, who
right.
I knew quite well in Vienna. I covered many of these stories for Newsweek, being serving in places like Berlin, Vienna, Warsaw, and Moscow. And then you had, but not all of them were Holocaust survivors. Not all of them were Jews by any means. There was Beata Klarsfeld, who was a German woman. Her father had been in the army. She was born in 1939, so she didn't much know what was happening. It wasn't until she went to France to become an au pair at age 20, she meets and falls in love with someone called Serge Klarsfeld, whose father was killed in Auschwitz. And suddenly she learns this history of her country, and she becomes this fervent person who's denouncing anybody who had been responsible for this. And some of these people had integrated back into high positions in West Germany, and she mounts this furious campaign against them.
Was it your time stationed in Berlin on behalf of Newsweek that drew you to this subject matter?
I think I've been drawn to it all my life in some ways. My father, my parents came from Poland. My father was in the Polish army, then escaped, was in Polish army under British command. I grew up hearing war stories. But yeah, living in Germany, living in Poland, later on as a correspondent, you heard all these stories, and they're endlessly psychologically fascinating. We're fascinated, morbidly fascinated by the perpetrators, the people who could commit such horrible crimes, and that's part of the story. But I also felt we didn't really give enough credit to the people who kept pushing for this, because once the Cold War started, there were the Nuremberg trials, the Dachau trials. Once the Cold War started,
yeah,
most governments didn't want to have anything to do with it. And it was a few people who kept pushing these cases in each of these countries that really got it going.
And it's also fascinating to learn, too, I've read about this for years, places around the globe that have provided safe haven for Nazis, in particular South America.
Yes, that was the, you know, one of the things, there are a lot of myths about this, that all the Nazis fled to South America. Of course, not all,
yeah,
a lot of them just sort of blended back into the landscape. But the people who really felt that most at risk, a lot of them went to South America, most famously Adolf Eichmann, who was the person who arranged all the logistics of the final solution of the killing of the Jews. And famously, the Israelis mounted this operation in 1960 to kidnap him, bring him back, and the only Nazi perpetrator who was executed in Israel. And I actually found that in Israel there were two of the Mossad agents who had kidnapped him were still alive, and I was able to get their stories, and that's just fascinating.
Yeah, I would think so. Yeah. Having the opportunity to get their testimonies. And we have a call for author Andrew Nagorski. The new book is The Nazi Hunters. Let's go to Mike. Hi, Mike. You're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. You know, one of the most interesting things about these folks that committed these crimes, at least the second tier of them, is just that they were ordinary people, some of them. What do we learn about their stories and what caused them to get caught up in such heinous acts?
Sure. Thanks, Mike.
Yeah, Mike, that's a very good point. I mean, while I'm focusing on what I call the hunters, the hunted, the people, in other words, the people who committed these horrible crimes, the psychology of them is something everybody's fascinated with.
Mm-hmm.
And for instance, the Allies captured a man by the name of Rudolf Hess. He was the longest-serving mm-hmm. commandant of Auschwitz. So he was helped construct this whole machinery.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a Polish investigating judge who questioned him. And part of the whole thing about these trials and it was not just to punish people, but to figure out the mentality of these people and to put on the record so no one could ever deny that this happened. And Hess freely admitted and talked about, oh, I was doing my job. I was so overworked. And he talks about improvements in the camp, more people into the gas chambers. And one moment he's talking about herding women, children into the gas chambers. The next moment he's complaining, oh, I was so overworked that I didn't have enough time to spend with my own children. And you say, what is the psychology of that person? How does he not see the connection? And of course, in the trial of Adolf Eichmann, that was a big thing. There was this phrase, the banality of evil.
Hannah Arendt's famous phrase, which
caused real controversy, because either you see these people as some sort of monsters, aberrations, mm-hmm. and in some ways what people worry about is that sort of gets everybody else off the hook. We were led by monsters, therefore we're not responsible.
Yeah.
But if they're just ordinary people who, for whatever reason, just did this, it's more troubling, because it's sort of everybody who went along with this is in some way responsible.
And your book, I think, gives testimony to this in a way that reminds not just Germans, but the world. This book is widely available now. How easy it is for people to slip into that madness.
Yes, it is. It's very chilling. And I hope one thing that I think everybody, every one of these Nazi hunters had in common, and most of the trials have made clear, is that it's never an excuse to say, I was just following orders, which everybody from the highest Nazis on down tried to say, because you have a moral responsibility. If you have what is clearly an order that is inhumane, it goes against every international norm, every concept of human rights, it isn't, you do not execute it. In fact, you have a moral obligation not to.
It's a pleasure to speak with you, and you've relocated here to St. Augustine from New York, so we're glad to welcome you to the community.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
He's award-winning journalist and author Andrew Nagorski, former Newsweek Berlin bureau chief, and his new book is The Nazi Hunters, available now. And we are back in a moment.
At MIT, researchers are figuring out a way to manufacture medicine on demand. You could produce life-saving drugs when diseases break out in remote places, or create meds on a battlefield.
We're giving them an alternative to traditional plants, and we're reducing the time it takes to manufacture a drug.
Portable pharmacies later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Spend some time in the square, an online venue for local artists. WJCT invites you to vote for your favorite submission. Vote now through the end of the month. To learn more about the square and to place your vote, visit wjct.org/thesquare.
In 1971, Robert Rosenthal was working an entry-level job for the New York Times when an editor called with a story of a lifetime.
He says, I want you to come to room 1111 at the Hilton Hotel tomorrow, and don't tell anyone where you're going, and bring enough clothes for at least a month.
And down the rabbit hole we go.
I slept in a room with two huge filing cabinets. I slept with the Pentagon Papers.
On the next episode of Reveal.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Mistakes were made.
There were mistakes in leadership, mistakes in communication. There were huge mistakes in the basic assumptions about the war.
A former soldier, now Secretary of State, and a commander-in-chief visit a former war zone. Obama's Vietnam moment. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Weekdays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
Next time on The World, a guaranteed basic income. Voters in Switzerland decide next month whether to give every citizen there $2,600 every month to help relieve the worst effects of poverty. The Swiss proposal is not the first. We hear what happened when similar programs were tried in other places around the globe. The argument for a guaranteed basic income and the news on The World. Weekday afternoons at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, they are First Coast husbands and fathers who are passionate about creating a community in this area for SODs. That's stay-at-home dads. A growing number of men in our area and all over the country are choosing to stay home at least for a time to raise kids. That's something in the past almost always moms did, but that is just not the case anymore in 2016. Right now, we're hearing from stay-at-home dads of Northeast Florida as we welcome Chris Hoskins, David McPhee, and David Torellio. Guys, good to see you. Good morning.
Thanks for having us on.
Good morning.
Thank you.
And you brought the kids with you.
Yeah.
We've got three little beauties in studio. And let me just say that I can relate. For many, many years, I brought my girls with me everywhere I went because I had no choice. David McPhee, let's begin with you. Tell us a little bit about your group. There's a website and a podcast.
Well, I mean, I'm not actually responsible for the group itself. Chris is responsible for the group. But I became a stay-at-home dad when about 14 months ago. Well, not 14 months ago. A couple of years ago, I did it for about 40 months solid, and I'm sorry, we've got catastrophe going. But we started the group basically as a matter of relieving stress.
Right.
I mean, a lot of us are isolated. A lot of us become our own little islands, and I found out the Jackson group, which was Chris, and I started a podcast, which I brought Dave on, and it was just so that we could actually have a little bit of stress relief and adult
network. Sure. Chris, tell us about the podcast and tell us about what it's like now that you have sort of a network of guys in your same position.
Well, David actually started the podcast.
Yeah.
I just actually started the Facebook group. It started off just as like a Jacksonville group. And once I met David, it kind of expanded to Northeast Florida. But it was just to have that interaction with other dads. I mean, there's plenty of us out there, and after sitting around TV and watching TV all day, it kind of gets to you.
It can get a little boring. David Torellio, you brought your 13-month-old daughter with you, and she's, hi, how you doing? she's running all over the studio. You know, and you guys will know more about this than I do, but anecdotally, when I've talked to other dads who are staying home, they'll say, oh, you know, when I take my kid to a playgroup or to the park, often I feel a little strange because the moms don't know what to make of me. Has that been an experience you've had at all?
On a regular basis, really. We go out to the zoo and we get the comments like, oh, it's daddy daycare. And it's not daddy daycare. This is a full-time job.
Right.
But like going out to like the library, and they have predominantly mom groups there. And, you know, maybe one or two moms will talk to you. But once another group of moms show up, then you're just sort of isolated and you're just sort of that guy. And sometimes you sort of feel like just the outsider in the group.
And you'd like to change that. You'd like to change that perception and change that dynamic, right?
Well, I think we've certainly changed the outlet side of things. I mean, we've had some very successful groups up to now. We had a group on the weekend where we had nine dads who actually got out on their own. David's running regular weekly events where they go out and they do things together. So we're already making a difference. We already have somewhere for guys to go.
And you know, I would think you help each other the same way moms always have, helping babysit, helping each other with errands and all kinds of whatever you need, you help each other out.
Yeah. it's a big support group.
Yeah.
I mean, there's several times me and David will converse, or he'll just let go, David.
Chris has been the guy to help me push off the helicopter parenting where I'm a first-time father, and this is our first child, so I'm always concerned that she's going to get hurt. And Chris has been like, Dave, it's okay, you can let go. And so that type of support.
More than one, so yeah.
I've been there.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I was that way with our first. And then the second one, you know, it was a completely different story, of course. That's how it always seems to be. But so let's talk a little bit about how maybe there are some families listening right now that would like to join your group. The podcast is sahdpod.com, sahdpod.com. And the Facebook group is really active, too. Can you tell us about that?
Well, the Facebook group's actually where everything happens. That's where we all get and we talk and we arrange our events. But we've branched out because a lot of guys aren't on Facebook, so we actually have a website now, which is sahdnefl.com.
SAHDNEFL.com. And where are you off to now? Where are you guys off to now?
Actually, we've picked up a new hobby of disc golf.
Oh, nice.
And we've been playing it for about 3 or 4 weeks now. And we've actually, it started off just as meeting at a park. And one of our guys had a disc golf and we kind of threw. And now we all seem to go buy discs, and I think some of us are even still playing it on our phones on an app.
Nice. And you've got your daughters sitting there on your lap. What are their names?
I have Sophia, which is a four-year-old, and Lauren's just turned three Wednesday.
I wasn't sure if they were twins or not. They look like they almost could be.
About a year and 6 months apart.
They are such cutie pies. It's exciting to have the kids in the studio. Look for this segment later today with our partner TVJax.com on video. But they are the stay-at-home dads of Northeast Florida. Chris Hoskins, David McPhee, and David Torellio. Find them on Facebook or online and listen to the podcast. So, such a great chance to meet all of you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us.
And we'll be right back with Culpepper.
I'm Catherine Burns, one of the hosts of the Moth Radio Hour, and I hope you'll join us here on 89.9 WJCT. With true personal stories told live without notes to standing room crowds around the world, Moth stories aren't part of the disposable daily information flow. They stick with you, and you'll even find yourself retelling them. Listen Saturdays at 3 p.m. here on 89.9 WJCT.
This is the sound of drama. This is the sound of your community.
Good morning, live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross.
Stay informed. Enjoy live streaming of your favorite local WJCT and PBS and NPR content, all free from your devices. The WJCT app, available now in the Apple App Store and Google Play.
Peggy Balzer was the first Florida Folk Arts Coordinator in 1976 and later director of the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll talk with Peggy Balzer. We'll discuss the personal papers of Joseph Marshall from the American Revolution and revisit the amazing Wendover Dig. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour, the Jaguars will be on the field this week, but their top two draft picks will not.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Culpepper's here now with a look at the Jags, the Suns, the Sharks, and more. It's our Monday Sports. Good morning.
Good morning. OTAs begin today, the Organized Team Activities.
OTAs, yes.
Let's just call them off-season practices and
yeah,
be done with
right.
it, because that's what they are for the Jaguars. But as we mentioned, two of the guys who have been bringing a lot of the attention to the Jaguars this offseason will not be there. Jalen Ramsey, the first-round pick, and second-round pick Miles Jack, the linebacker. Ramsey was announced last week that he had a meniscus tear in his knee.
Oh,
he's
boy.
Getting a second opinion tomorrow in Alabama, and it certainly brings back the thoughts of what happened last year
exactly.
with Dante Fowler Jr.
Are we going to get cursed again?
There, you know, listen, you are not the first, nor will you probably be the last to start saying, you know, the curse of the Jaguars or the
I feel like I'm back in Chicago talking about the curse of the Billy Goat on the Cubs
right.
or something.
I will point this out. While the curse of the Billy Goat continues with the Cubs, although they've had a great season so far, the curse of the Bambino was lifted. So
that's
curses,
true.
Curses can end.
You can reverse the curse.
Yeah, exactly.
Somehow.
So I don't know how you do that.
Did somebody curse Mayport shrimp or something? Like, what was, I'm not even sure what we call this alleged curse.
It's been rough. And in considering all the expectations for the season for the Jaguars, that they have been sort of the vogue underground pick to win the division and go to the playoffs. You'd like to see these guys out there. Miles Jack's not an injury, by the way. He's the situation that you can only have a certain amount of time on the field, and it has to happen after your school graduates. And the Pac-12 schools are on a different system, different timing system than most of the rest of the country. So now the question is, what will the guys who will be out there be looking to do?
Yeah.
They're not in full pads. They're not hitting, that sort of thing. But I think one of the big keys is, with so many additions to the team this offseason, it's important here in the next week for Gus Bradley to start to let everybody know what the expectations are, how you know, the Jaguar way is. And we talk a lot about this team's way or that team's way, usually when they win. Well, Gus Bradley certainly has a way of doing things, and it's important for these guys to kind of learn that as they start the offseason process. They'll start putting in the offense and the defense and so forth to some extent. But really, it's about building culture and reinforcing the culture that Gus Bradley has developed.
A couple of other news and notes. The Suns beat Pensacola. They conclude their series tonight here at home.
At the baseball grounds. Should be a good scene tonight with great weather. A big crowd for the Sharks over the weekend as well, as they beat Portland 65-34. And Friday, they travel to play, say it with me, Melissa,
the hated Orlando Predators.
Exactly.
And the Armada losing all the way up in Ottawa over the weekend.
Yeah, this is why it is the North American Soccer League. There are teams in Ottawa and Edmonton in addition to the United States, but the Armada went north of the border and lost a heartbreaker 1-0 in Ottawa. An 88th-minute goal by the Fury was the difference after the Armada basically were the better team. The Armada now have been shut out the last four games, and they're looking to turn that around on Saturday at home. It is Military Appreciation Night against Indy 11, and as you know, whether it's the Suns or the Sharks, the Armada, the Jaguars, Military Appreciation Night is something to be seen when the teams in Jacksonville put that on. So
lots of dress uniforms and all of that.
Yeah,
right?
And great deals as well for folks in the military. I think they're offering a $5 ticket, so it's a great way to say thank you. And then a week from Wednesday, the Armada open play in the U.S. Open Cup against Charleston Battery. We'll talk more about that next week, but it's a really great event that could see the Armada on the national stage.
Excellent. And follow Cole for all of your sports news on Twitter at Cole Pepper. See you next time.
Thanks, Melissa.
That's our show. Thanks again for listening today. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Next on Diane Rehm, a look at where the 2016 presidential candidates stand on key issues like job creation, healthcare, taxes, and education. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.